You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith. Today I am speaking to the absolutely effervescent Matt Richardson, a man who I know as a stand-up comedian, but who in the last 10 years or so has had an astonishingly, maybe profound isn't the word, what's the word? Lots of. He's been on telly a lot. Hundreds of episodes he talks about, but not the sort of thing I watch. Matt is an absolute joy. He talks about his parallel careers as kind of like almost a TV personality, presenter and host, and occasionally guest on things like Celebrity Most Haunted House and stuff like that. Maybe you're into that stuff. I hope you are. There's certainly a lot of people that are. But it's not my wheelhouse at all. And so we have a lot of fun in this conversation, trying to get to the bottom of the difference between his two kind of parallel careers, the similarities between them, what frustrates him about the crossover between them or lack thereof. And then in the second part of this interview, we'll really get into some nitty-gritty regarding his own stand-up and maybe some of his bad habits along the way. He's very, very candid, which you know I always love on the show. And we'll also explore what it means to be good with mums. And in the extras, oh man, he's going to tell you how to do well on a reality TV show from a very insider perspective. So 25 minutes of extras with Matt Richardson, available to you if you're in the Insiders Club. If you're not, you can sign up at comedianscomedian.com/insiders. Right. Let's go for it. This is Matt Richardson. We'll begin with your showbiz lushness. What does that mean? And because you've got the reason I pick up on that is you've got an unusual relationship to showbiz as comedians go.
Yes. I would say I am one of, or you know, in my TV career, I am probably not a comedian. that's what I would say. Like I don't get booked for the comedy things. I get booked to do like, you know, very weird things. And I think that means that I've sort of slightly have erred into reality. And you know, I've done a couple of those sorts of shows, which means that, you know, lots of comedians are sort of showbiz allergic. Like, you know, someone like Sarah Millican doesn't go and hang out at showbiz places, whereas I fucking love it and sort of do love that side of the world a bit, but I just balance it out with then going and doing the Frog and Bucket in Bolton.
Yes. Okay. So do you have quite a sort of would you say that it's kind of parallel careers? Do you think there is a difference between Matt Richardson the comedian and Matt Richardson the reality show contestant or presenter?
Yes. So I very often will go on, because it's this weird thing of the kind of telly I've done, the amount of TV I've done like hundreds of episodes of things now, but I can't sell like 2,000 seats on tour. I can still sell like a little kind of 100-seater or 150-seater. But for me, I've got this TV career, so I get stopped in the street all the time, but I can't sell any tickets. They're so different to each other that it's really strange. So very often, I'm really sort of in the clubs at the moment. I'm really, really, really going for it in the clubs. And people come up to me afterwards and they're like, oh my God, I had no idea you did stand-up. And that is a lot of what my issue, the poisoned chalice of the direction my life has gone in, I suppose.
When you say poison, does that hurt? Does it burn when people say, I didn't know you were a comic?
No, not at all. But I'm just like, God, I wish you did, because then I could go and do a proper tour.
Okay, so let's go with that in mind. Teased the audience, hey, there's this famous telly guy that you didn't know was a comedian, but you should. People should know you as a comedian. I know you're definitely known on the circuit as a comic, but then
I think within comedy for sure. Like I'm very much, and like I've always like really like hit the clubs hard whenever I've done anything. So it's not like I've never not done comedy. Like, you know, like someone like I know Alex Zane, and he just sort of doesn't do comedy. He stopped doing comedy and just did presenting, and then sort of dipped back in and out. Whereas I've always gigged.
That's interesting that you mention Alex. I don't know him well. I think I've only worked with him once, where it was a sort of a corporate day out where he was the host of all the events, but he was the sort of he was the profile host where Muggins here went on and did all the interstitial warm-up. It'd be like, I'd host. And then I'd go, right, back in my box, here's your host. And then he'd come on and say a few words. Which is that. You have no resentment there at all. But from what I know of Alex, he was sort of fated as a kind of next big thing of a comic. And then I suppose, and I've not spoken to him about this, so maybe it's sort of incorrect of me to say, but my assumption was that he was kind of a young, energetic, fun, funny comedian, and telly went, oh, you should be presenting, and then offered him so much money to present that he never went back to comedy. Do you think that's fair, knowing him?
I do think that's fair. And also, because I sometimes will, but he lives not that far from me, so I bump into him like getting a coffee. in TV land, where we all live near each other. He lives around the corner. Weird, totally coincidentally, so I bump into him every so often. And he's like, oh, what have you been doing? I was like, oh, well, I did like three gigs last night. And he just goes, why? Why do you bother? And I'm like, well, also, Alex Zane was making telly when everyone was getting paid silly money to do telly. Okay. So he's like, I don't need to do loads anymore. Whereas I'm like, I still need to gig to eat.
Yes, okay. So let's zoom in on why do you bother? Why do you bother? Like, you do need to do gigs to eat, but there are other ways of... You could focus more on telly. Clearly, there is something in you that's like... Like, do you... When you wake up in the morning, or when you give your job title to people, do you say, I'm a comic? I'm not talking car insurance. I'm talking, like, socially. Do you identify as a comic, or do you identify as a TV presenter stroke personality?
Yes, I identify as a comic, and I've... And the thing, my thing is I've a massive chip on my shoulder about not being kind of like a credible, cool comic because I've gone and done Dancing on Ice and things like that. Like, and it does sort of bother me a bit. Like, coming on this podcast, I'm like so excited because this feels like a little nod from the industry that I am an actual comedian.
Yeah. And I had to run you past the board of the Comedians Comedian podcast. There were several pitch meetings where I really championed you against the faceless board that represents the comedy industry.
Yeah, and you know, the comic who said this to me once shall remain nameless. It was one of the most hurtful things I think someone said. And this comic has said quite a lot of hurtful things to me over the years, really. I don't think we get on. But the last time I saw him at a gig a few years ago, we were doing this awful gig together, at a university. And he went, oh, I'm surprised you're here gigging because you're sort of more of a personality now, aren't you? And that, like, cut me to my core because I take stand-up really seriously. And I, like, you know, I really love being a comic and I love gigging. Like, if I could gig three times a night, seven nights a week, I absolutely would. Like, it's my favourite thing in the world.
Okay. And so what does being a personality mean to you that it hurts so much?
I guess the fact that, you know, it's like, oh, you don't have this skill anymore. And I think that's the big thing with comedy is that I'm really proud that I have a skill set. I meet lots of reality stars and people like that who don't have skill sets, and I have a real sort of badge of honor that I am a comedian and I can go and like be a carpenter almost and work in between these TV jobs in the clubs while they're just waiting for the next thing to come along that they can just say yes to be paid again. Whereas I see it as a really hard thing to do, comedy in entertainment. It's the hardest of all of the entertainments. That's my genuine opinion, and I'm really proud I do it. So I get really annoyed when people go, oh, you're not really a comedian anymore, are you? And I'm like, Yeah,
someone said to me years ago, he's like, oh, are you still on the circuit? And there was someone, like a peer, someone I'd come up with, and they said, are you still on the circuit? And it hurts so much. I was like, am I not doing it enough? Like, just because we've not been in each other's orbit, like, what do you mean I'm not making waves enough? I'm not kind of profile enough? But then the circuit isn't profile. It just means we haven't run into each other. But I experienced a similar sort of ouch sensation, because I'm like, you're not just talking about the thing I spend my time doing, you're talking about my identity and how I perceive myself. And I think that that's I think now when I reflect on that, I think actually I don't know how healthy that is for my identity to be so wrapped up in me being a comedian. Do you think it's healthy? Is it simply that you have kind of like desire for that and it's perfectly healthy that occupies so much of your mind?
No, I don't think it's healthy. And so I had a weird experience with it where I did a radio show for a few years, and basically and I'll talk about it very frankly, it came to an end, and it came to an end in a really horrible way. Basically, I was on Virgin Radio for four and a half years. Chris Evans came in to take over the breakfast show and disliked me. Which meant the writing was on the wall. But rather than get rid of me, they made my life as miserable as possible in the hope that I would leave. Mm. And it got to the point where it was such an affecting thing, I basically came to terms with no longer doing any of this.
Yeah, okay.
And I had a moment where I went, this is so awful, I don't want to do comedy anymore, I don't want to do anything, because it was such a hard time. And that moment for me, I think, was a turning point in having a much healthier relationship with being a comedian. Because I've done it since I was 18. I've always been a comedian. You know, basically, it's the only thing I've ever done. So it means that it was really hard. I kind of had this sort of 6 weeks where I kind of had to mourn the loss of being a comedian. And then once I'd mourned that loss, I'm a better comic for it, I think, because I'm less stressed about being a comedian and what that entails and what that means to other people and what that means in my life and on the circuit and to other comics as well. So I think that's the hard thing with this job, is you do really care about what your peers think of you.
Mm-hmm. Just when you said that, and you had to mourn the loss of being a comedian, not mourn the loss of being a radio person.
Because I was going to quit everything.
Right, I see.
It was such an awful experience. I'd been a comic for years, obviously, longer than I'd been on the radio. But I went, I am done with all of this.
I see what you mean. All of this in the sense of everything.
I was having thoughts and saying
them with your mouth to audiences. Anything.
I was going to go and retrain to do something totally different. I was going to go and find a totally different job in a totally different sector, like go and work in advertising or go and work in some other, God knows what. You know, I was going to go back to university or something like that. And I'd totally accepted that. And then I ended up leaving Virgin and I went to Edinburgh. I did a really kind of low-key Edinburgh where I just did the Tron and sort of did it as kind of half old stuff, half new stuff, kind of like, and had like the best month I've ever had in Edinburgh, just enjoying it. And then I went, okay, cool, no, I can still do this. But the fact that I'd sort of, in my head, detached from it, I think gave me a healthier relationship with being a comic and being, you know, in that world.
Yes, yes. You,
I'm a better comic now. I care less about it being wrapped up in my identity.
There is I'm sure there's a word for that. It's like, it's one of those kind of hero's journey kind of tropes, isn't it? That like you had to let go of the thing to discover what you really all the time in a kind of way. Do you know what I mean? Like one of those things, but true.
Absolutely. And also, look, I think a lot of people have a career wobble. You know, when it was happening, you know, in my late 20s, and I think a lot of people go, what am I doing? Like a friend of mine quit his job and because he hated it, and kind of spent 2 years kind of working out what he wants to do, setting up his own business. And it was around the same time as that. But it's just that even though my job is cool because I'm a stand-up comedian and everyone thinks that's a great job, I think I still had a mini career crisis of like, is this what I want to do forever and feel like this? Because it's a stressful job and it's a job full of rejection. Do you think, do I want another 20 years of no's and indifferent audiences.
Before we get, I want to get stuck into the comedy bit. This is the greater part of your career. Before we move away from the kind of the TV, the fluffier kind of the presenter kind of things,
yeah.
What is it that makes you a good presenter? What is it that people like? Not just on radio, but just, you know, what are your qualities that people warm to in the world of TV? Like, I can see you on TV on these shows and go, yeah, that makes sense, but I can't articulate why. Yeah. Can you?
No, I can't. I think I think why I've always worked is I'm sort of quite light and fluffy, but I'm slightly abrasive. So on these shows, I've always done really well on when you know big reality shows always have a spin-off show where they have people coming on to comment. Yeah. And they sort of, I'm quite good on those because I'm very good at sort of being a bit cutting.
Okay.
But not too cutting. So I think that's always like, and I'm a little bit sort of like that. So I think I can do all the, hey, welcome to this and this and this. But then also there's a little edge of, nastiness isn't the right word, but of sort of the comedian, I think, in me going, well, here's something to undermine that slightly. Mm. And I think that quite works. I think that works. Although in some shows, it's just you need to be light and fluffy and there's not really much else to do.
Yeah.
So, and does that just is. Oh, he's
got. Do those maintain your interest? Like, are you fine with just being light and fluffy? Is it fun enough?
Yeah.
Is it kind of engaging enough for your brain that it's telly and you're doing a job and hitting your marks and saying the right thing? Is that kind of absorbing enough?
Yeah, you know what? So I've never done a show where I've gone, oh, this is boring, like TV stuff. Like, so I've done lots of live telly as well. So I did a series on W. We did two series of a show called Celebrity Haunted Mansion. And Chris, once again, one of these things no one's ever watched.
I don't think I've heard of the channel W.
So it's part of the UK TV.
Oh, I see. I very briefly worked for UK TV, writing interstitials, yeah. Writing links, at just around the time where they came in and said UK TV G2 is going to be given a new name. Can you think of anything? To our little writer's room. And then none of us could. And then 6 months later, they said, we're going to call it Dave. And I rolled my eyes and went, well, that's not going to work. Well, more fool me. Yeah, I don't know anything about TV. Well, so would have been... Was it the... What channel turned it?
Watch.
It was Watch. Okay.
It was Watch. And I think, you know, they've got Dave is for the men and W is for the women. That's basically how it... So, like, Emma Willis has got a show about delivering babies on W.
Great.
Like, things like that. Like, it's very much kind of that
so
leaning
side.
So
W is for women, but discreetly. It's like a soft acronym.
Yeah, gotcha. It's a soft kind of like... I would say that their audience skews female in the way that Dave probably skews male. You know, not overly, but
yeah,
it does
sure.
skew
yeah.
that way. So Christine Lampard and I hosted a TV series called Celebrity Haunted Mansion, where we put 10 celebrities into a haunted mansion to do real seances and real ghost hunts with proper ghost hunters.
God forbid you got any unproper ghost hunters there. Well, could have been a disaster.
Rather than doing it like, you know, like a Derek Akora where it's all fake and they throw things round and all that. Like, we went, no, it's going to be done seriously. And it was for a week. It was a week-long stretch. 3 hours a night live TV. But the problem is, ghosts aren't real. So... It ended up being a really good fun show because we basically had to just pull 3 hours. Oh, and also there was 3 hours a night and a spin-off show at tea time. So I hosted the spin-off alone that was like talking about what hadn't happened the night before. But the second series of that, we were doing it in this. Nothing really happened. We had really good celebrities, like people like Katie Price was on it and Alison Hammond. Like, we had they really splashed the cash on it. But on the spin-off show every day, it was me and two producers going, well, there was nothing happened. So we basically ended up just doing whatever we wanted for an hour a day because the stakes on that were so low. Like, it was the highest rated show in their 5 p.m. slot ever, and we were getting 75,000 viewers.
Okay.
So we basically went, well, so like, we had a ghost work experience on the show who every day would do like a different job, and no one from the channel went, you can't be doing this. We go, oh, we're just going to do this today. And they're like, whatever you want. Absolutely great. And even though it's one of those shows that you think, oh, that's going to be like a really dry thing, it ended up being really good fun because we just went, oh, we can do whatever we want with this. I've never done anything boring, I would say. Like, I've never done sort of any magazine-y kind of one show-esque things, which I know that Ian Sterling and Joel Dommett have done a bit of now. I think that would be boring. I've done a show where Katie Price is in a seance going, if there's any ghosts in here, feel free to touch my tits. I was like, yeah, this is really entertaining to be making this. And it is thrilling. Like, live TV is really good fun. And I really enjoy the teamwork aspect of making a show.
Okay.
That's what I really love about it, is that we all come together and, like, everyone's trying to make this thing, which is the opposite of standard.
And presumably as well, there is an element of you which is kind of without, like, for all that you enjoy undermining stuff for the sake of a comic premise, like, you do really get off on stuff which I would consider to be a load of shit. Do you know what I mean? Like, I would go, I'd be climbing the walls if in a celebrity haunted mansion. I'd just be, it would upset me. I'd feel unlike myself. Whereas I think your tastes are such that you can go, well, this is just a laugh.
I like all that reality stuff. Like, I come from a place where, you know, I don't watch all of it, but I watch The Real Housewives of Beverly Hills and all that. Like, I love that kind of stuff. Like, it does suit my taste. As a comedian, I'm not a comic. And I think there are comics that have strayed into reality things that sort of hate it.
Okay.
Whereas I don't hate it all. I'm like, well, this is absolutely batshit and brilliant and ridiculous. And I really enjoy that element of it.
I think that's probably a big part of your kind of bookability as a reality peripheral person. It's like, if you're clearly enjoying yourselves, people want to work with people who are enjoying themselves.
Absolutely. And also, I've done loads of these kind of, you know, where you talk like the you're fired-esque shows on The Apprentice, which I've never done that one because I don't watch The Apprentice, but like, I only do the ones where I watch the show anyway. Okay. Like, whereas I've been in green rooms and there are people going, so what's that guy called? And you're like, God, you've just taken the job. Rather than, because I think people, especially these shows that have got mega fans, and the people watching spin-off shows are the mega fans of those shows. They can sniff out if you have not watched it. So I remember years ago, gutted, I should have done it. I got asked to do the Game of Thrones.
I was just thinking of Game of Thrones. That would be the only thing that I could contribute to.
So I got asked to do it years ago, and I went, oh, I don't really watch Game of Thrones. I don't watch Game of Thrones. Whereas what I should have done is started watching Game of Thrones, because I then started watching it 2 years later and went, what the fuck have I been missing out on? I could have been paid to do it, which is, it was the one, I did a Westworld one where you talked about Westworld, and I loved Westworld. So that really worked. But it's, you know, so I've done the slightly more, you know, high-end heritage ones.
Prestige Red Button. That's very, very much my genre. And yes, I have it on good authority from a source that you are incredibly good with mums. And I'm interested in how that quality, what the dynamic is between that quality and your telliness.
I would love to know your source. That's really funny. I really enjoy the company of middle-aged women. Like, I think the thing is, I'm really close with my mum. Like, my mum and I are very tight. So it means that I think I've always had that kind of relationship with. I like other people's mums. Like, I like chatting to other people's parents and things like that. I find it really interesting, and that's part of the show. Like, basically, it's the same skill. It's just interviewing punters.
Yes.
But yeah, who told you I'm good with mums?
It was Angela Barnes, but not unsolicited. I asked for some insight from someone who knows you well.
Oh, brilliant! Yeah, I'm quite happy to sit and chat to anybody, and I love, like, I'm the person who, like, my girlfriend and I went bowling last night, and, like, I struck up a conversation with the people on the lane next to us, and she's like, can you not?
Okay.
Like, we're out bowling. But I want to talk to people and, like, talk to everybody. Yes. And I think that's what makes me good with mums. I'm genuinely quite interested in having a chat with everyone.
So when it comes to your stand-up, what qualities that make you good at reality telly make you good or hinder you in stand-up?
I would say, you know what? I don't think there's anything that hinders in stand-up. I think stand-up makes you better at every other job in entertainment. That's my genuine belief, that you put a presenter on something, if you find a stand-up that can do that, they will do it better.
Yeah, okay. Why is that? I mean, I think because, I would react to that in kind of a, because I'm a stand-up, I'd go, well, yeah, obviously, because, like, we've been running with lead weights for years worth of gigs. Like, we're ready for anything. We're like a start-up. We're like an, you know, all of that.
Exactly. It's exactly that, is that you know, someone who has been, you know, and loads of people, they learn on the job in live TV, you know, people who've done like hundreds of hours of live TV, like Holly Willoughby or whoever, you know, start in kids' TV and work their way up. But stand-ups, like, no one's thrown a pint at her.
So, okay, but does that make someone implicitly better at the nuance of a job? Because I remember my equivalent for that is having done years as a street performer to then become a stand-up. I thought, well, wow, I've got so many hours behind the wheel, and I have, but I think about it now and I think, well, maybe in the beginning I had to unlearn all of that because actually I wanted nuance as a comedian rather than just bash, 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 look at me.
Yes, and I think with the presenting side of it, I remember my first day of doing a presenting, my first ever presenting job, but the first day, the producer pulled me aside. She went, look, great day. We should have spoken about this before because you're new. You've never done this. When they tell you something, that is not a jump off for you to then do a story.
when they're queuing you up, they're not queuing you up. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, yeah. You are the secondary.
Gotcha.
It's about them, not about you. Whereas I think with stand-up, I had to sort of unlearn the bit of going, well, I've got a better thing about this with a punchline at the end of it, so I'm going to do it anyway.
Gotcha.
You don't do that. You let... That was quite hard, because you're like, oh, but I've got the thing to say. I've got a better thing to say.
Yes.
So let me say my better thing. But it's not about that when you're present... Especially, like, I've done lots of things with punters, like, you know, with real people that you have to kind of, like, meet and things. It's about them. It's not about you. And that was really hard, because stand-up is all about you, and you need to get in the funniest thing, and that's not what those kind of shows are about necessarily. So I had to unlearn that. But when things go wrong, being a stand-up, I think, and doing the, you know, really doing the hours in the clubs, when something goes wrong on telly, it's never as bad as when it goes terribly wrong in a club. So you've just got that bit of you that's unfazed, because you're like, yeah, the auto cue's down. There's been some technical issues here and there, but I'm not at the Frog and Bucket on a Saturday with a group of stags yelling the word cunt at me. So therefore, I'm quite chill about this.
This is Matt. I mean, you can tell, right? If you were casting anything that required a bubbly, funny presence that can just walk up to anyone in the street and talk to them, Matt's your guy, right? Like, he's in a really, he's so sort of, well, I mean, you can hear what he's like. He's great. He is like, I mean, as he says himself, a caffeinated puppy. So we're going to hear more from Matt. We're going to talk about, in the second half of this, we're going to get more into his stand-up. We're going to talk about the dynamic between his OCD and his fear of doing badly on stage, and how that may have had a long-term effect, how that might have hampered his creativity, as it does, I'm sure, for all of us. I mean, what would the comedy pantheon look like if no one had any fear of getting things wrong, fear of bombing, fear of promising a good time to everyone and then letting them down? Just, I mean, it would be unrecognizable. Imagine your favorite comedian. You might think they're fearless. They're still scared. Imagine if they were actually fearless. We're going to get right into that, and it's really good fun too. So you can follow Matt on Twitter and TikTok at MattRichardson3. I imagine he's on Instagram as well, but I haven't bothered looking. Maybe he got there first and is at MattRichardson on Instagram. Who knows? You can go to mattrichardsoncomedy.co.uk. Presumably one of Matt Richardson's 1 to 2. Already got the .com. Bastards. You can do that. You can follow this podcast at ComComPod on Twitter. And I mean, if you want to follow the Instagram, you can, but there's literally nothing on it. Go to comedianscomedian.com to catch up with the show. I really must get around to updating that, because I think there's a little widget on that WordPress website. WordPress is a horror, but I think it goes, hey, coming up, Pierre Novelli. That was absolutely 6 months ago. And you can find out everything I'm up to at stuartgoldsmith.com, including my remote and in-person talks to business, in which I distill insights from the very nearly 400 comedians who've been on this show to help you cultivate resilience and the ability to bounce back to all levels, from team members to what I recently learned is called C-Suite. And you can find out all about that at stuartgoldsmith.com. Now, let's get back to the wonderful and just so much fun to be with Matt Richardson.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Let's start at the beginning then, stand-up-wise. You were a teenager when you did all the new act competitions, and you were in the finals, I think, of... You were a sort of finals person?
Yeah. I think it was quite similar to you. You know, I was in the finals, but I didn't place.
I often came third.
did you?
I think I came third in one of them. Oh, God, I can't... You fact-check that. I think I came third in one of them. Because my friend said something particularly hurtful. He sent me a text at the time saying, everyone remembers the third man on the moon. So I've got myself... I've got it in my head that I'm a third guy. But no, I think you're right. I think I didn't place.
Yeah, I was the guy that was left in orbit on the that didn't even get to go on the moon. So like my finals, yeah, I started very early and then did like So You Think You're Funny, Chortle, Student Comedy Award. I did all of them, but those are the two big finals I was in. And then I don't want to brag, but I am the runner up of the Reading Comedy Festival New Act of the Year.
Nice.
Henry Ginsberg beat me.
Oh yeah, Henry.
And I won like the Newbury one and the Bar. All the little ones I won, but the big ones I was very much like. Probably placed
eighth. Okay.
On the night. And you know, if there was
any. And the key thing is, you were a teenager at the time, like 18, 19.
So You Think You're Funny, I was 19 for the final of that.
And what was it that attracted you to comedy at the time? Like, who were the people that you wanted to be like?
So I have wanted to be a comedian since the age of 14. This is my teenage dream footballer job. Which is great, but I used to love. I remember being in a parents' evening when I was at sixth form, and the teacher was a really great teacher. I had my politics teacher, and he said, "What do you want to be?" And I went, "Oh, I'm not really sure." And my mum went, "No, I think you should tell him. I think he'll get it." And I went, "I want to be a stand-up comedian." And he went, "And you absolutely can.
Oh.
He goes, you've got the right disposition." He's like, "You've got." He told me what I think is a compliment. He went, "The things they teach at private school." You've got like that confidence in yourself and that assuredness, so you go and do that. If anyone can go and do their dream, I think you can. And he comes to gigs to this day, like he's an absolutely amazing man, Mr. Browning. What a great gent! I don't think I'd do it.
That is an incredible. That guy, he was your careers advisor. Was that the no?
He was my politics A-level teacher.
What an incredibly supportive thing and an incredibly supportive mum. And like, I wonder the extent to which that is reflected in the origins of many more comedians these days than it ever has been. I remember speaking to Harriet Kemsley came on the podcast. She was talking about watching Live at the Apollo with her parents and her parents going, "You should do that." Do you know what I mean? Like just, oh, it's absolutely beautiful. It's lovely. But that idea that like just a real sort of positivity and nurturing and going, yeah, those, and particularly I'm very interested in that quality that people who have who go to private school have. What is that quality? It's not just confidence, is it? And I suppose it's kind of verging on entitlement, the sense that I'm gonna, whatever I do, I'll fit in. And actually, if you behave like that, you often do fit in because you just kind of convince the world into it.
Also, I think starting stand up so young meant that I just went, I think when you're, I can't believe it now, but like I remember being sort of 19 and comparing jonglers and thinking, what idiot would let a 19-year-old, but also now I would go, no, don't go. If a 19-year-old comic went to me, "Oh, I've been booked to compare a weekend at jonglers," I'd be like, don't do it. It'll be a nightmare. Mm-hmm. it's not for you. But when you're 19, you just go, yeah, fine, I'll do that. Like, and I think I very much had a fearlessness that I was like, well, I'll go and do a gig and I'll enter that competition. And I didn't really think about, oh, well, will this make a career or not? I was just like, yeah, why not? Because I just wanted to do one gig originally to see if I could do it. And it was fun. So I did another one. And then someone... and then Milton Jones was doing a tour date in my hometown. And I emailed him asking to support him on his tour date. And I had done two
gigs.
That
is private school confidence, which I register. You didn't go to a private school, but that's private school confidence.
Yeah. And I just went, hey, I've been doing stand-up. I'd love to come and do like 10 minutes before your gig. And he sent me, and he doesn't remember this, which really, which I think is really sad. He sent me, well, the loveliest email about like, hey, I've got this guy that comes on tour with me. Obviously, you're quite new. Tour support is a bit more different. Like, really explained what the differences were. And then he went, however, the position you're in, there are these competitions. Yeah. And you should do those. And they're all called this. And these are the websites. And enter them. They all happen all year. That's what you should do. And that's why I ended up entering the competitions. I hadn't heard of So You Think You're Funny when I'd only done two gigs in Oxford. Yeah. But Milton Jones sent me this absolutely gorgeous reply, sort of basically going, fuck off, but in this direction that's going to be beneficial. This will be good for both of us if you fuck off.
That, again, what a lovely supportive thing to happen upon two gigs in as well. Not happen upon, but to make happen from your perspective.
And you know what? I think what people often ask me about comedy is like, oh, is it really competitive? And, actually, everyone is very supportive. When I was new, there were a few kind of... you live in Bristol now, so Olver, mm-hmm. Mark Olver, very much is a big advocate of new comedy and helping new comedians. And there are loads of those people on the circuit that just go, yeah, come and do this, why not? You know, like, and I think that is a really... But I came from that atmosphere pre that. So my mum was going, yes, if you want to go and do comedy, like, you go and do it, because there's nothing worse than being on your deathbed going, I wish I'd done that.
Yeah, for sure.
Like, I think my I had a grandparent who was like a really good singer, and they could have probably done it, but they didn't. And then they wish they had. They went, go and fail at it, and then you can say you tried it at least. Yeah. That was my mum's attitude of go and give it a go. And if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. But you gave it a go, so you can never live with that
regret.
And
what were your kind of main weapons as a comic at that early stage? Was it sort of, I mean, you clearly seem to, like, you're a very fluent talker. And you're very enthusiastic and you have a kind of bubbly sort of get on with people energy. I mean, there's something I had in the early days was people would always say, oh, as soon as this guy walks on stage, you relax, you think this is going to be fine. You know, and I was like, oh, that's kind of annoying. I'd rather they said he's really funny, but no, you've got to accept that. Comedy teaches us you have to accept that what they all think must be the truth. So what did you have that kind of like the optimism, the kind of naive self-belief of adolescence?
I remember one of my first ever reviews, they called me a caffeinated puppy, which was, so I was super enthusiastic and I thought, you know, all my stuff was about things that were, like, I really loved kind of like, you know, I loved the Russells basically were my kind of real big loves. Like Russell Howard was my favourite comedian ever. And, you know, it's really cool in comedy because you get to meet your heroes because everyone does smaller gigs in life. I know Russell fairly well now. And but he was someone that I really liked, and my stuff was very kind of like this this brilliant thing, and like I loved that sort of comedy. Whereas I'm not so much like that now. It's much more it's kind of, I've sort of fallen into a different flow, but it was like, hey, this, my friend said this hilarious thing, and then this hilarious thing happened. It was all very like, isn't life great, was my sort of weapon. But also I had the great thing of going, I am the youngest person in the room. And that's a really nice jumping off point of, this is how I see your world as a 19 or 18 or 19 year old when I first started doing the clubs.
Yes, I think it's really useful. That's a really interesting observation. Yes, if you come with an inbuilt angle of any sort, then you don't need to walk on going, well, what should we talk about?
it's hard. And I think anyone that's got that straight away. So, you know, I used to just come on and basically reference my age, and that would get a laugh. I'd have a joke about how young I was, and then that would be it. And then straight into your thing. And it was all about living at home with my parents and, like, you know, finding your mum's vibrator when you live at home with your parents and all those sorts of things. So it worked because the audience that I was playing to were probably in their late 30s. Even now, comedy clubs, I'd say it's sort of 30 plus, isn't it, really, mostly? Unless you do Top Secret and then they're all children. But they're all very young there. But so I was always, like, I had this angle that, like, I'm talking about your life from your child's perspective, and that really worked, I think. And then you kept doing it, and then I noticed it just slowly started to not quite work as much because I was getting just that little bit older. Once I got to sort of like 24, 25, people are like, no, you're an adult now.
Do you, when you look back at that period in your kind of your oeuvre in comedy, do you recognise any kind of bad habits that you would have had as a younger comic who was just kind of 99% enthusiasm and let's do this?
Yeah, I would. I had loads of bad tics on stage. Like, I used to say right all the time. So right, when right, I was doing this thing right with my friend right. That was one that was, because I think I was so scared of not talking. Yeah. Whereas that's something I think I've grown into. I still talk. I talk really fast on stage. I always have, but I'm not afraid to not talk for 5 to 10 seconds now. Whereas when I first started, I just needed there to be constant.
That's kind of a classic motor male thing, isn't it? Because if you've done well and been rewarded by, you know, in career terms and audience terms by the fact that you're talking really fast, the idea of letting go of anything that you started out doing must be very frightening.
Yeah, and I think that was a really bad habit. Like, I used to watch, because when I started out, it was like my school year is sort of Angela Barnes, Ramesh, Rob Beckett, who were all quite a bit older than me.
Yeah.
So they had that life experience. Like, Ramesh used to come on stage and it would take him like 30 seconds to do his first joke because he's not afraid to stand there and do it slowly.
Sure.
That opening joke where he goes, you know, I know what you're thinking. I don't know if you remember this. It's the
best opening line. Absolutely. Yeah.
I know what you're thinking. Asian comedian going to be banging on about being Asian the whole time.
Yeah.
Only 5% of my set is about being Asian. The other 95% is about my issues with white people. But he'd really pause between the banging on about being Asian and let them all go, oh, and like play with that bit of the audience. Yeah, yeah. From day dot, he wasn't afraid of that, whereas I was afraid of, I'm not going to leave any gaps here. I think that was a bad habit. You know what? I was a compare quite early on. Like, I think probably like you, I got into comparing really quickly, and I was really bad at, if I was talking to someone, I wouldn't go, they're giving me nothing, I'm going to move on to someone else straight away. I would like drill down and down and down and spend 10 minutes getting nothing from this person. And that was a really bad habit, especially when I was comparing about 50% of the time.
Yes. Okay.
That I really remember that distinctly, kind of running a couple of gigs into the ground properly because I just wouldn't let this one person, I'm going to win this battle.
I wonder if there are some tropes, like I've watched a fair bit of your stuff on YouTube from some of it from a long time ago, the everlasting Chortle award set, which is
my fourth ever gig is online.
You poor bastard. I think people, and for probably 5 years ago...
Did you see the Frog and Bucket one, the seventh?
I don't think I saw that.
It's a proper death.
Oh,
and
God.
Steve won't take it down, and I've offered him money.
Yeah. This is it. This is, I mean, one of the big secrets in comedy is that if you search Chortle New Act and the name of any famous comedian, chances are it's there, and Steve will not take it down.
Yeah, but, absolutely.
I wonder if, I spotted a couple of kind of tropes that you were doing things, which are things like I've always thought of it, like artificial jeopardy, when you kind of tell a story. I don't mean you personally, I mean this is like, it's a trope, a lot of people would do this. I go, and then this guy said the funniest thing I've ever heard. You know, where you kind of where one artificially inflates build up of tension. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I'm really bad, and I still do this, and it's weird, actually. A comedian sent me an unsolicited email after he'd seen me, and my first joke is about a funny getting a heckle me putting the guy down and the guy saying something funnier back. And he said, you should be the funniest person in all the conversations. Yeah. Whereas I've got a, I think, and I still do this, I'm very much like, this, I was in a situation where something funny happened, but I wasn't the funny thing. And I think that's a trope that I still use now a lot.
Yes.
And I try to not do that. I try to write jokes rather than, I was at a thing that happened.
Yes. Yes, I think that's fair. I do see that person's point. And I, listen, I'm not going to stand here and say I've never offered people unsolicited advice, which
but
I
But it wasn't four paragraphs of an email, do, was it? When you've not seen each other for 8 years.
No. But I think of that as comedy reportage, and there was a lot of that. And I think that's partly the Russell Howard effect. I think he did exceptional kind of like, this thing happened, and kind of breathed lots of life into strange little random encounters, whether they happened or not, and always presented as if they did. And
I think there's a lot of that. All my bits are less so now. I've sort of started to go in a bit more, a couple of bits especially, sort of slightly more observational, but it's all stories of things that have happened, like you say, whether they're fiction or not, and you inflate them in whatever way. This guy said the best thing ever, and there's a lot of that.
Yeah. And there's a lot of that kind of, and this genuinely happened,
exactly.
And you're like, well, I know you're lying. You know, that kind of stuff. Like, what? How does it serve the story to know that something genuinely happened? Like, what? Just tell us a funnier thing that you made up. Do you know what I mean?
So it was a lot of that to begin with. I think I was never really, until the last few years, I've been better at writing gags within stories. Like, but it was very much something happened and this was funny and that was funny, rather than like basically retelling stories. Like, I remember the 2.5 stars I got in Chortle for my Edinburgh show in 2017 from Jay Richardson, in which he implied that I might be a paedophile because of my fascination with young men's anuses, because I had...
Right. Hence him presumably knocking off half a star.
The review, I invite anyone to go and read. I had a really good run that year. It was the only bad review I got. And he came on the fourth day and Steve didn't put it out till after the Fringe. Because I think even Steve knew it was brutal. I think even Steve went, I've seen that. This is harsh.
Okay.
He spends an hour regaling things that have happened to other people. And I was like,
yeah. And do you think that was fair?
No. Yes and no. So yes, I think it is fair in that show. I look back and there's probably one or two too many bits that I think one bit like that is fine, or maybe two bits spread out. Mm-hmm. There was probably one or two too many stories like that that hadn't happened to me, that had happened to a friend, and I'm retelling them. And also in that show, I read out, once again, my weird life of my sort of reality things. There's quite a lot of slash fiction written about me on the internet. Where
yes, of course, okay. And it's slash fiction written about you.
Yep.
You can legitimately respond to it.
So I did a show where I basically read out in between stand up. I'd sit on a stool in a single spotlight and would dramatically read the gay erotica that had been written about me and Harry Styles. And he went, well, he's just reading things off the internet. And I was like, you know, because it exists, but you know, I've written this stuff. Like, I think he's never reviewed me well. And I think he took everything at face value to sort of just like demean me. But it did look like the point of it was, these people are writing these weird things about me on the internet, but I had written all of them to make them funny.
I see. And did you tell the audience that you'd written them? Or is it the case that you were pretending something had been written, you read it out, and a reviewer said that they kind of took it at face value and said,
I read out four or five little bits. And I was like, no one writes erotica with a gag every 30 seconds. So that I've clearly taken some of these things and like reworked them into better things. You know, and written some...
Yes. Okay. But you're doing like a magician. You're doing whilst pretending not to do that, and then can you really complain if
Jay Richardson, who you know has seen more comedy than most human beings on the planet, didn't know what I was doing? God, he hates me. And But the thing is, I was really hoping for Julia Chamberlain. Like, I you know, but never mind. She said she couldn't review me because we get on too well. And I was like, that's the point of why I want you to come and review me, Julia. There's a lot of that at the beginning. And I think less so now do I do those things of the, I've got this story and this thing happened to this guy I knew. And, oh, my God, isn't this crazy? Whereas to begin with, that's all my stuff was, pretty much.
And do you recognise a kind of a maturity in your writing? Like, what is it you're looking for when you write? Because I think that kind of early Matt, we can look at him and go, this guy just wanted to be having fun getting laughs.
No.
And there's nothing wrong with that. But if you there's enough people out there just wanting to get a laugh, have fun, have the kind of enjoy the sensory experience of being a comic and a compere and all those kind of things and travel the world. That is a complete, you know, that's the kind of the circuit dream to which so many newer comics or aspiring comics aspire. And then you kind of go, actually, if you want to build a crowd and if you want to compete in a very crowded marketplace, you need to refine. You either need to be the best guy at reportage or you need to refine your own voice.
As I've gotten older,
a
lot of my stuff has become, I do quite a lot of bits that, like, I would say are, oh, wow, this is overshare. This is quite an intimate thing to talk about. Like, I've got a joke at the moment about how foreplay for me starts, because I'm on antidepressants, so foreplay for me starts 2 weeks before, so I can taper off my meds so I can maybe come. I think that's a very intimate thing to go. And like, and I've started that as I've gotten older, it's sort of more stuff like that are being like quite sort of visceral in a way of going, this is something that is quite an intimate thing to talk about, but I'm not afraid to sort of say it because I think we all have a similar experience. Like, you know, like the tampon bit I have this long old tampon bit that is sort of in my set and it has been for a while. And it's about removing my girlfriend's tampon because she was too drunk to do it herself and sort of being very honest about going, well, I don't know anything about, I've never been taught about tampons. So these are all the thoughts I've had about tampons while I'm doing this bit. But as I've gotten older, what I want is a gag rate, really, that I think when I was younger, I was, like, I think I had gags, but now it's a story that I think 10 years ago I'd have gone, oh, that'll work. Now it takes me 2 years to get to a point where I want it to be where I'm happy with it.
Okay. Is it telling it in such a way that it's a kind of a loose, fun, lively retelling upon which you happen upon jokes? Or is there a sort of sit-down
so
craft,
I am now
chip away kind of
really thing? Trying the chip-away craft element, which has never been my bag. My bag has always been, I've had this funny idea, and I'm going to keep doing it on stage. And that was the beauty of comparing all the time, is I could kind of just drop little bits in, and they would slowly grow. But now I've tried to go, okay, I've got this bit, it's a funny idea, but that's not enough anymore. I want a joke every 30 seconds, and I'm trying to write the jokes within the bits now. But for me, I'm much more of a, I need to try this. I've got a bit that I remember doing. Do you know, obviously this is a nerdy enough podcast, I can reference Tiny Gigs, can't I? You know, so the Fighting Cocks in Kingston outside the box.
Yeah.
I spent a year comparing it every other week. And I had a joke, and I was like, I know this is going to work.
Okay.
But and it's the same crowd that go to that gig every week. And I just kept trying it in different ways until they went, yeah, that's the one, lovely. And like, but that's kind of how it works out for me. And then, you know, bits naturally fall away or get added. But I'm really trying the writing thing. I'm really trying to do it now because my turnover is low. I've never written at 2 hours, 2 years on the trot, ever. Like I wrote an hour in 17, I wrote, and some of that was a bit older because I'd never done Edinburgh before. I did an extra half an hour. I think, you know, the oldest bit of my set at the moment is probably, well, I guess the pandemic doesn't count, so it's probably like 3 or 4 years old. But there is one joke in there that is 8 years old if I'm doing a club and if I feel like I need it. But I'm not like Zoe Lyons, who every time I see Zoe, I'm like, well, there's a new 10 minutes in this. Like, she just churns because she sits and writes, and I'm trying to be better at my turnover.
And do you think that is a decision you've come to later on in the day than some, because you're busy?
I've not had to do Edinburgh every year, so I think, you know, people also I came to Edinburgh later in the point where Edinburgh, there's not so much stock in Edinburgh anymore. You know, it used to be, you know, in the late 90s, early 2000s, like, God, you do Edinburgh and that's the way you get seen. Whereas now there's so many different avenues and things. So I've never been on that grind of writing an hour every year. So I've never had the discipline. I think, I remember, what was it? Was it Ellis James maybe once said to me that, the second hour you go, I can't do this again, like I'll never write another hour of comedy. But then after you've done that second one, you go, oh, this is fine, I can do this every year. But I've never done that, so I'm scared of chucking everything away and starting again. I'm very attached to bits. So like I had a bit that was in my set for quite like a good 4 years, and it isn't anymore. And it naturally fell away as another bit got bigger, and I was like, I always thought I'd end on that for my whole career, and I still feel like that about bits that are in my set now. Like I am very scared to go and just go, right, I need to start again. Like I'm worried I will never write anything else again.
Yes. Yes. Well, listen, we know that the cave you fear to enter holds the treasure you seek. Right?
And like, so yeah, and you know,
is that what you've
got
to do?
I'm also terrible at getting to a new material gig. Doing a couple of new bits that like are sort of half baked and I need to work out really, and then going and then just doing 10 minutes of absolute crackers like that. I'm terrible at that, and it's a waste of my time.
Is that fear?
You know what, I saw the other day, one of the best things I've seen recently, I saw Mickey Flanagan doing new material at the Boat on a Tuesday, and he didn't really have anything, and he didn't have the best gig of the night, and it was really interesting just kind of watching him kind of work it out and just have that confidence, because he's Mickey Flanagan obviously, but just to go, I'm gonna have to die to make this good, it's gonna be shit to begin with, and I'm scared of that bit. if I could be handed a polished 10-minute routine every 4 weeks, I would take that deal. I find writing really hard.
Do you? What steps have you taken? I mean, good for you for saying so. I admire your candor. Have you taken any steps to deal with that? Have you ever kind of thought, well, why don't we get in cahoots with a newer act who writes for Mock the Week or someone? Or why don't I kind of build up a relationship with a specific person, and maybe if that relationship tends towards they start being the power behind the throne and they write the gear for me? Because clearly what you love doing is being on, like, more so than you... I mean, tell me if this, I'm incorrect in this assumption, but you seem to love being up there doing it, getting the laughs, more than you have a burning desire to express your inner...
Absolutely, like, I don't have anything that I think is important that I want to write and do that I think people need to hear. You know, I really love performing. I'm a performer who writes so I can perform, not the other way around. And I think I've never done that power behind the throne thing, mostly because it's quite expensive. Also, like, I do really want to be good at it. And I think if I did that, because I think I'm getting better as a writer and I'm writing better jokes and things, it's just taken me a lot longer to get there than some other people. And I've been a bit too scared to push, like you say, enter the cave with the treasure. And I think that is, it's only since the pandemic really that I've gone, I'm going to really start pushing myself to, even if it's like finding a new 2 minutes within a routine, like that's, I'm finding that really satisfying as well, and like really trying to expand everything. So I love comedians that do, like, you go and see Michael McIntyre and he does 25 minutes on one thing. And I love that. I think that's just amazing. And I want to do that with my things now. Rather than going, I've got this joke about this thing, I'm like, I've got a bit. It's this chunk about it that I can just do. And I'm trying to like expand things that are older, as well as coming up with new things that could then potentially be longer. It's just, to begin with, they're one joke that's not that funny, and I hate that.
Here's one joke from 10 years ago, and if I can just expand it, then I won't need to feel
I've got
nothing.
Someone was talking to me about the other day about the Beatles documentary, and I've not watched it on Disney Plus, but they said that Let It Be came from a song that was like a song they'd sort of written 15 years before, or like 10 years before, that didn't quite work out, and they'd gone back to it, and then it became Let It Be. And so I'm now also,
Since... Okay. And you thought, yeah, really,
but this legitimizes my approach. All the notebooks I've ever had. So I've now gone, oh, maybe I'll go back through, because stuff that I wasn't good enough to do, I might now be good enough to talk about.
Yes. I have. I did that for my second year. I went back through all my notebooks, my second hour, and I haven't really done it since. And there's a lot of notebooks. And I suppose I have, because the notebooks became on an online note-taking app. So I've occasionally kind of rifled through that. But there's definitely value in that. The bit, I mean, I've not seen the Beatles documentary either, but I did see a tiny clip on social media, which is Paul writing Get Back. And apparently the context of it, and I say this unseen, I say this purely from the notes on someone's post. Apparently they were like, they needed three extra tracks and the deadline's coming. So he just starts improvising on a guitar and kind of like, just kind of like, you know, singing, like just singing notes and la rather than words. And he just, you watch it for 3 minutes and it just turns into Get Back. And you're like, I guess that's how you write a song, right? Do you know what I mean? Deadline, pressure, confidence in ability, relaxing into the process, and just kind of free fall.
I'm not brave. I'm not a brave comic, I don't think, when it comes to trying things. I remember, you know, seeing people go up with notebooks and things, and just acts I really admire absolutely die doing this new stuff, and they're like, "Well, none of that's any good." And I'm like, "But I want them to love me." And like I'm afraid of not having that good gig, and I feel embarrassed if it doesn't work, and then I lose confidence in it and myself. So I would say I'm a wimp, I'm a coward when it comes to new material.
Let's just drill, if we may, slightly further into that, because the design, I don't know if it's cowardice, but the experience of having a bad gig, that kind of exposed feeling, that awful feeling, is. Yeah. I mean, it's horrendous, and I'm sure it keeps loads of people out of ever trying comedy, which benefits us in some ways. But it's something which people who haven't felt it have never felt anything like it. You know, it's its own unique, painful thing. You mentioned the desire to be loved, and you mentioned earlier on, and forgive me if this is an unusual connection, but you mentioned antidepressants earlier on, which surprised me, because I suppose you are so bubbly and outgoing and enthusiastic. And I wonder to what extent, we were talking about one's identity as a comic, certainly for me, it's a huge deal to unpick my identity separate to my identity as a comic. And I think it's healthy to do so, and it takes a bit of time. But what is the relationship between your mental health and your work and work when
the reason I'm on antidepressants is I have obsessive compulsive disorder. And so I take antidepressants as a treatment for that. Sertraline saved my life. Brilliant. Okay. My relationship with it is the only time I wasn't having unpleasant obsessive thoughts was when I was on stage. When I first started comedy and I hadn't sought treatment yet, it was that 10 minutes and sort of the 20 minutes in the car afterwards, that buzz, I go, oh my God, I've not been thinking. I've just been like, I'm so high on the gig. So I ended up doing, my first year I did like 300 gigs. My second year I gigged so much because for me, that was like a bit of a release. So I kind of found I'd found the pill that had cured it. It just cured it for 20 minutes a night. Whereas now I take antidepressants but they are an off, sort of an off label treatment for the obsessive compulsive disorder.
Gotcha. Okay. So does that, well then let me, because if that's a kind of a, kind of connection to have made. What's the relationship then between the kind of the fact of if in your teens you were self-medicating for OCD by gigging, like what kind of comic does that turn you into? Is that part of why you fear it going wrong? Is that fear less to do with, oh, I'm going to lose my dignity? And it's more that like, oh, I won't be able to touch that sort of calm place that I associate with being funny on stage.
I don't want the reality. I don't want the real life. I want the life on stage where everyone likes me and everyone's laughing. Like, I am compulsed by having good gigs. Like, I know loads of comics that are like, well, sometimes you've got to have a bad gig to get stuff to work. And I'm like, no, I can't. I can't see how that works. I have to.
Because you associate it not working.
Yeah, basically, almost. Yeah, pretty much. Because like, good gigs would then keep me happy in the car ride home, you know. Whereas, like, bad gigs, oh, you're straight back down to earth. Whereas a good gig, you can ride that adrenaline and that dopamine to... Because that's what antidepressants do, don't they? They fill your dopamine receptors. And that's what a good gig does. So it's exactly that. And I think... yeah, I was sort of compulsed to always have a good gig. Like, I would never be someone that would go, well, you've got to kind of like have these sort of iffy gigs with bits. Only more recently have I kind of gone, I need to just grin and bear that. It's become a bit of a problem that I will go to a new material night and not do any new material because I don't think it's good. I'm like, oh, I can't bear the fact that this is going to be crap.
It's a big part of the creative process, isn't it?
Failure. Yeah, it's part,
and if you're so failure averse, if you're so averse to failure, then you'll always, as you say, you'll be compelled to not risk it. And if you don't risk, then that has effects. That has like kind of compound interest, long term effects.
Of course, it does.
Your creativity, the discoveries you make, and ultimately, one might guess your position as a comic, your opportunities as a comic, your ability to grow an audience as a comic.
Absolutely. You know, like, if ultimately, like, say long term, if I wanted to keep doing this and keep doing certain things and be able to, what we all want, really, you know, you spend your entire new act career trying to get on the circuit, and then you get on the circuit and then you're trying to get off to go and tour and things. You know, Sarah Millican, it writes, like, does a new tour 8 months after her last tour. Because she sits and writes and does new material gigs and fails and fails. Whereas I'm afraid that if that's the place I want to go, I can't do that because I've stagnated in this area where I'm afraid to do those bits. I'm afraid to do the shit to, you know, I'm afraid to crawl through the shit to get out of Shawshank.
Yeah.
You know, I have to do that bit. And I've really started pushing myself now to do it more.
So what we need to do to cure this is to create a reality show in which you have to crawl through some shit. In which case, the fun of doing it, will, like, if we can create a show whereby the game is to have the worst stand-up gig you can, you could, would that cure your compulsion? Because the fun of the game...
Well, it's like that the Radio 4 show, Don't Make Me Laugh. Like, that would... I did a run through where they were kind of developing it, and that was fun, but it was weird. Like, it is weird because comedians can't help themselves.
Yes, but that's interesting.
I need to also start going to be brave enough of going, that's my best bit. I'm getting rid of that to write a new best bit.
Yeah,
I'm too attached to what works and too afraid of getting things that don't work to work in the process that takes. I think. And that's my biggest weakness.
With what little I know of OCD in general and your OCD particularly, do you think that has, even though you're kind of medicating for it and you're coping with it, is there an element of it which feeds into that kind of clinging on to stuff? Like almost the process by which you experience not wanting to let go of stuff. Is that connected to it, do you think?
Yes, and I am like I'm a creature of habit. Like I think it's that thing of I like what I like. I eat the same five meals every, you know, like those kind of things. And I think it's a little bit like that. I've got a set I'm really happy with. I don't need to try avocado. You know, it's sort of basically like that. I am very, I'd say very much so. But I just need to be, my whole thing is I'm not brave enough. And I think I love seeing comedians who just, every time I see them, I'm like, God, there's so much more in this 20 that's great. And, you know, Zoe Lyons is my favourite comedian on the circuit. Like, the circuit kind of touring world, if Zoe's my, like, comedy hero. Like,
gotcha.
I admire everything she does. I think she's so talented. But she just turns material over like nobody's business.
Yeah.
And I just, it's like magic to me. But I don't see the process she goes through to get those bits. I just see her every 6 months when she's got the new bit done.
Yes.
And I think... Once again, not to reference the same book, but Jimmy Carr's book about, you know, it's mostly failure, this job. It's mostly things that don't get made, that don't get laughs, and all that. And, like, it was really reassuring to listen to. It's really changed my perspective on comedy, actually, which is really... I wasn't expecting it to. I was expecting, you know, an autobiography, not a book that kind of made me think, yeah, I need to be braver and need to push myself more. But it has really kind of put me in a different mindset.
What's your favourite opening line of another comedian and why?
My favourite opening line of another comedian and why is the Ramesh line that he used to do. So that would be my favourite opening line of...
And the why is specifically because of your kind of envy of how he waits.
Yes, and also I just think it's a great gag as well.
Yeah.
I love when Steve Hughes used to come out and go, I'm thinking the same thing about you people.
Yeah, sure.
That I thought was a really gorgeous opening line as well, because it's sort of a really clever way of doing the I know what you're thinking.
Yeah.
But it's just the phrasing of it is a really beautiful little bit.
If you had one quality that got you where you are in your comedy career, besides your ability to tell jokes, what would it be?
If I've got one quality...
Non-comedy performance related.
I'm very good at the booking gig side of things. I have Sean Olmey does my club gigs, but when I started, I was better at admin than everyone else.
We never go into that. What are your top three admin tips for new comics?
My top three admin tips are just like email. I went and found every gig in every town. I Googled towns and comedy clubs and open mic nights, and I found them, got the contact, and just applied for every single gig and did that. I dropped out of uni to do comedy full time. And my dad, who worked from home, said, look, whatever time you get in, you get 8 hours sleep, then I wake you up, and you sit, and you either write or you do admin.
So he thought, I will do admin, please.
I'll do the admin, actually. But what I would say is, with that is, because my dad said to me, this is a job. Yep. This is your job now. You need to treat it as such. It meant that I would try and apply for like 10 gigs a day. That was my kind of thing in my head when I was new, is I would try and get 10 gigs in my, like, not get them in the diary necessarily, but I'd send 10 emails to people a day asking for gigs. Mm-hmm. And that's where I really benefited. I think of my generation of comics, I was sort of very much known as like the one that is gigging all the time.
Yeah.
So that's the one quality.
That's good. That's very interesting, actually, because you were very quick at getting back to me when we were organising this. Yeah. Every email I sent you, every WhatsApp message I sent you, immediately pinged back, and that is uncommon.
I'm good at that side of it. Even now, I'm like, because I want to book things. I just like booking things in. I really want my diary to be full, mm-hmm. and I'm very on that side of it. And I think there's loads of great comedians that fell by the wayside when I started because they just couldn't really be bothered. And like weren't very good at that bit. And I probably wasn't the funniest, but because I was doing more gigs than anyone else, I got funnier quicker.
Great answer. How do you cope with failure? How do you cope when it goes wrong?
The only way I cope with it is if I, if it's not my fault, if it was totally out of my control, I don't mind at all. So if you do a gig and it's unplayable for various reasons, then it's fine. The only time I really struggle with failure is when I get off and I go, I could have done that better. I didn't give that bit quite the right inflection there because I couldn't be arsed. Mm-hmm. That's when I really beat myself up. But otherwise, if it fails because of things outside of my control, great. I did a corporate thing a couple of years ago. And they opened, they kind of got in touch and they opened by going, we're aware this gig's unplayable. And I went, well, then yes, I'll do it. Because if it goes badly, who gives a shit? They've said that.
Why was it unplayable? What did they consider made it unplayable?
So it was a property management awards. And they just said they just said every year they're just so hammered and so rowdy. Like it was like estate agents. They're like, they're really cokey and rowdy and nutty. And they're like, everyone does it and tries to do stand-up. They're like, don't even bother. Just go in and do the awards and like get through it. And I ended up having quite a fun time.
Yes,
because I went in with no pressure.
Great. I did an overseas gig where we got off the plane. The guy met us at the airport and said, well, no one has a good time here. Let's all just get through it. And suddenly all the comics relaxed and we went, great, let's just have a fun time. And as a result, we all had a much nicer gig because we've established the parameters.
Exactly.
You won't be letting anyone down to do badly here.
I only get nervous at nice gigs. I get nervous at clubs that everyone... My least favourite thing to hear from another comic is, oh my God, that club is just like, it's never not good.
Yeah.
Which is, I mean, now that I book the Comedy Cellar in Bracknell, I'm using that line a lot to get people in. But it is, but you know, that's the worst thing to hear. Like, I remember Ginglick. Do you remember that gig in the toilet?
Yes, yes.
And I remember people
I have very mixed memories of Ginglick. I had great gigs there and some real shockers.
Yeah, but
real,
I had
TV
I
people who are all cool.
I remember people
school.
Going, oh, it's so good. Oh my God, Ginglick is amazing. And then I did it, and it was one of the, it was like my first 10 for CKP as well. So I really wanted to get in with them, like because they had loads of gigs at the time, and it was an absolute disaster. And I hate that. That I really struggle with.
Are you happy?
Yes, I would say I'm the happiest I've ever been in my stand-up world as well. Like I'm really proud of where I sit in the whole stand-up thing now, and I think that's made me happy. Like I've sort of closing all the big clubs now and kind of having loads of fun gigs and just really enjoying myself, and sort of people are excited to book me or want to book me, and that's made me really satisfied with work. And also I've got a great home life. I've got, you know, a wonderful girlfriend, and we've lived together for years, and I think that really helps you be happy with comedy when comedy's not your only thing.
Thanks, man.
Thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure.
So that was Matt. What a joy. What an absolute joy. Always put a smile on my face talking to him. And some very valuable tips there on hammering the admin. And actually, we didn't talk in depth about spreadsheets. I wonder how he keeps all that shit together. But maybe his neurodiversity assists him in that regard. Who knows? Thank you so much to Matt. Great to get him on. And I have to say, Matt, I didn't mention this at the time, but I always used to gently bully you for looking like one of Ned Flanders's children. And I, to be honest, you've grown into your face a bit, and I don't think that's an appropriate jibe anymore. But thank you. What a joy. And just, you know, you know what I'm like. You can always hear the smile in my voice when I've listened back to him a bit, and really genuinely thought the guest was a barrel of laughs. Now we're going to I'll post Amulet in a second, because I'm off to South by Southwest. And probably by the time you hear this, I might be in the air or already there. But in real time, as I understand it, it's still about 36 hours away. But I've got a bit of an update there. You can find out more about Matt Richardson, 25 minutes of extras, in which we'll talk a bit more about his presenting career. We'll talk about the Joel Dommett effect, whatever that is. We'll talk about coach trip. We'll talk about relatability. We'll talk about how you play the game of doing well on reality TV and exactly what he was looking for beyond stand-up. So loads of stuff to enjoy there if you're in the Insiders Club. comedianscomedian.com/insiders. Join for a minimum £2 a month, or as much as you want to, as much as you want to support the show with, as much as with which you want to support the show. Nonsense. Go to comedianscomedian.com/insiders to find out about that. And everything I'm up to is at stuartgoldsmith.com. And on either of those pages, you can join the mailing list, which will get you access to the video of last year's Zoom Q&A with James Acaster. And every time I think of that, and you also got the mailing list, every time I recall that and the brilliant ones with Alfie Brown and Fern Brady, Nish Kumar, I think to myself, do more of them. They were so fun. Podcast host promises to do anything. Immaterial. But who knows? Maybe soon. That's very exciting. I'll post Amulet you shortly, as I said. Thank you to Matt for coming on the show, to Nathan Wood for producing and uploading the show. Thank you to Jake Crossland for the logging. Your podcast consultant and my South by Southwest pal is Peter Dobbing, provided we can both get the numerous dots dotted and T's crossed with the various COVID protocols. And this podcast exists exclusively as a sort of mental crutch for Brett Goldstein. Speak to you soon. Well, this is the post-amble, because, as I said, I've got very little time in which to do things. Say thanks to my friend Sam for helping me buy the world's best tripod for a camera, and everyone that suggested the Sony A6400. That's what I went for, and holy moly, it's great. And Sam has also given me a link to a light, which I bought immediately, because it's like having the moon in your seller. Did I mention this before? I've whinged for the last 2 years about recording stuff and doing Zoom gigs and online gigs and what have you from my cellar. I've whinged like, God, here I am trapped in a cellar. Only very recently did I realise that if you live in London or have a small house, that's a huge boast. Apologies, I don't live in London. And although the house is small, it has a cellar. And I'm in it now, freezing my nuts off. Bad news, I'm afraid, fans of Jim Gaffigan. I'm really sorry we had him in. He was all booked and everything for South by Southwest. I'm afraid Jim is no longer able to do that. There was also the vaguest possibility of an incredible stand-in, which one day I might tell you if I see you in person. But they seem unable to do it either. We have, however, the brilliant Byron Bowers, who has had one hell of a life and turns it into comedy gold, as well as the genuinely sensational Dulce Sloan. And I'll repeat what I said last week. If you haven't yet seen Eddie Pepitone's special, it's called For the Masses. It's released by 800 Pound Gorilla. It's available on their YouTube channel. For the Masses, Eddie Pepitone's new special. I think it only went up 6 months ago. It is a masterpiece. And listen to it as homework for the Eddie Pepitone Returns live special that's going to be happening in Texas this weekend. I have a thing to say. Oh, this is it. Look, it's a bit of a spruik, which you know the Aussies love that word. And email me to tell me. Chops Comedy is mine and Mr. David Hoare's club, which also has a relationship with the fabulous Tony Chiotti, who we hope will return to the fold before too long. We've had some incredible headliners there. We don't reveal who the headliner is until the night. It pretty much always sells out the night before. We've had people like Ahir Shah, Mike Wozniak, John Hastings. We've had Olga Koch. We've had Jade Adams. We've had Stu Goldsmith. He's on fire at the minute. Bilal Zafar. We've had Alistair Beckett-King. We've had wonderful, wonderful people. John Robertson's been there as well. It's just brilliant. There's so many great acts there. And it's such a lovely, intimate little club. Only seats about 45, 50 people. So find out everything you want to. I think you can go to chopscomedy.com and it will punt you onto the Facebook page. That's probably it. But you should get along to that if you're in Bristol. It's every Tuesday night. And it's just such a lovely little vibe of a room. And I'm doing new stuff most weeks. New stuff every time I go. I just don't go all the time. But it's a joy, and it's really... Oh, I don't even know if I can mention... I mean, look, I'm doing Edinburgh, right? It's not an official announcement, but I am doing Edinburgh, and I'm doing a bunch of warm-ups before I go to Edinburgh, and it's only a little-y, so it should be super fun, but I don't know if I'm allowed to tell you yet, so I'm going to shut my yap and find out. I don't see why I wouldn't be allowed to tell you, but probably I'll do some sort of big fanfare thing. And here's a thing. I need some new merch. I would like some new merch. I'd like a new design. What shall we do? We had Polly Becker's sensational kind of horse sheriff's badge for years. The original ComCom Pod one back in the day when I thought putting the Twitter handle on a t-shirt was a good idea. And then more recently, of course, that's a few years ago now, we had the brilliant Bees Fuck'em design that the wonderful Lise Richardson did for us. So we need a new one. I need ideas. First, I need ideas for what the thing could be. And then I need suggestions of who could do it for us. And we should do that because I want some more merch. I want finally, every Christmas, I think we should have mugs. We're having mugs this year. I said it. So give me a shout and let me know and send in your suggestions, please. That's that. I'm going to go and do a jigsaw with my dad. Not a euphemism. Bye for now.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.